Love is not blind. It doesn't exist.
Look at Dune 2. You see the end of Dune 2, bitch.
You all think you're in love. Blindsided. That's how love is. Welcome to Podcast X episode 48, the official podcast of us. I am your host, Ben Kendrick. I'm joined by my co-host, Mr. Rob Keyes.
Hello. How's it going, guys?
Good. And special guest, Kofi Outlaw.
The Kof Melange.
We are going to be talking Dune 2 this week, as well as some, it kind of sounds like some television shows that we've been watching. So Shogun. What did you mention, Rob? You said one too.
I forgot what you mean. What did I mention? The Last Airbender, Ben.
Oh, The Last Airbender. The Last Airbender, which was just renewed for season 2 and 3, right?
That's right.
All right. So we'll start off with Dune 2. We might get into some other stuff. I've been watching Daredevil season 3.
Sure.
Everybody's request. Yeah, no, I have. I took a break from it for a while. I'm about three quarters of the way through it.
Okay, stop. What do you mean you took a break from it?
Three quarters of the way through it. I'll tell you a funny story about it. I'll tell you a funny story about it when we get to that. Okay. All right. So which one of you guys wants to go first? It's probably most fresh in your mind, Rob, but I know.
Obviously, the big thing we're here to talk about, which is Dune fucking 2. Let's go.
Yeah. who wants to go first?
Season 3 and shit. Like,
hey, Ben's living like four years in the past.
Dude, yeah, vlogging commentary has gotten so wild. People are like, yeah, I'm just watching this thing. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
It's been like 5 years. Like, yeah. Okay.
Dude, with Dune coming out, people were like, why didn't anyone tell me Blade Runner is so like visually amazing? I'm like, are you fucking – what? Like, are you guys kidding me right now?
It's wild.
I can't handle it.
But yes, we're here to talk Dune 2. I'm coming fresh off my second viewing in IMAX. Went back out last night with my brother and my father to see it with the normies. I hadn't been to see a normie movie in a long time. It was interesting. But I got to say that I kind of love Dune 2 even more the second time around because Denis and I've had some help from my French-Canadian fans over on the soon-to-be award-winning and empire-spanning comic book nation. My French-Canadian fans have helped me out with this. Denis Villeneuve. So Denis Villeneuve is kind of really hitting his stride right now. There is a legitimate case to be made for the whole Nolan versus Villeneuve showdown of cinema and their different eras. But this is real cinema. And I like that Denis is a person who is so much more visually inclined than verbally inclined. Like dialogue, all that stuff is not a real big part of any of his films if you really watch them. In the debate about what this movie is doing, like it's cinema in every sense. It's spectacle, great characters, great actors' performances. There's a point to this Dune, and it's not an easy point to digest. It's causing a lot of debate. The ending causes a lot of debate. And I'm loving that. It's kind of the Oppenheimer of this year where we're watching something that's at once entertaining, kind of film school proficient, and thought-provoking, and that's all good. And I have my own deeper thoughts about Dune 2, but you know, we'll get raw once everybody's gotten there. Everybody got a chance to pop off and get their early impressions out of the way. But this is, like I said, it's epic cinema in the truest sense, and Dune is officially, weirdly, a thing now, like, is leading the sci-fi pack. Who knew we'd be talking about that and like, yeah. And at the same time as Shogun. So all these things of the late 70s, early 80s that were big cult hits, the Shogun miniseries from back then, Dune from David Lynch are now coming back around and the shit is popping. So yeah, I was loving it.
Oh, I do want to talk about that, man. The whole like Viking scent, the very like Norwegian style sound effects, and certainly the Sardaukar, like to talk like that, right? Yeah. Ben, you go first. I got a Tim Hortons delivery. I'll be right back.
Oh, well, all right. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, I feel like I had similar feelings to you, Kofi. Like, I had, there was an earlier screening of it, and then I ended up waiting for a later screening. It was just, I mean, it was just a couple days later, but that one was in IMAX. And I intentionally waited for that because I feel like that is the way to see this movie. And while it would have been fun to see it, you know, a week or so earlier or something, I wanted to experience it in kind of that scale, because that's how I had seen Dune Part One and thought it lived up to the hype as far as IMAX goes. And yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head when it's like, as a director, he definitely, you know, things are kind of sparse a lot of times in terms of dialogue and in terms of exposition. And it ends up being more about the visuals and kind of how you communicate the story through the visuals in a lot of different ways. I mean, as far as like the visuals are concerned in IMAX, watching them like riding the sandworms through a freaking sandstorm at the end of the, you know, in the third act and like kind of the final battle may have been one of the coolest things I've seen on a screen this year. So, I mean, it's only March, I guess. And really one of the only other things I've seen is Madame Web. So I guess that may not be saying much, but I imagine it'll still hold up throughout 2024 as one of the coolest things that I've seen. And I mean, he does it. Like everything is very like, kind of awe-inspiring and sort of breathtaking from a visual standpoint. I think that, you know, the character work is maybe a bit choppier this time, I felt like, than maybe the first time. And that's because you're sort of expanding it out into more characters and more sort of, you know, you're bringing in the Emperor and stuff like that more. But I found myself in kind of moments, maybe especially with his mom and stuff, like that transition was a little rough. And then kind of what ended up being sort of showing the evolution of him as a warrior and a leader, kind of jumping very quickly between sort of these action set pieces, also kind of left me a little bit untethered at moments. But at the end of the day, like, I'm not going to hold any of that against the film, because it's still like, eventually I kind of got there. I understood everything that was happening and it was amazing to look at. And I feel like the emotion was still communicated through a lot of those visuals. I didn't need, you know, like a really in-depth training montage. I just, given the costuming and given kind of where we are in this world, like when all of a sudden a big like spice harvester is there and there's rebels attacking it, I didn't know that was like 3 months later or 6 months later. I thought he was like still in the desert. Like I had a couple moments of that where things were like, I felt like a little kind of like, well, where am I? And like, what's happening and how much time has passed? But it's nothing that takes away from the overall experience of the movie. It's just kind of like, you know, maybe there was another 15 minutes of this movie and I don't know that I would have needed to see those 15 minutes, but I did feel a little bit kind of untethered in a few moments. But I mean, that is like the one thing.
Did you see it once or did you see it twice?
So I've only seen it once. Yeah. I've only seen it once. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I've only seen it once. So, I mean, I'm sure in the, you know, the second time around, I'd kind of be able to see,
no, there's
like,
a lot
the way
of,
he was. Yeah.
No, there's a lot of details. And just, I was wondering, because it's an interesting scene to see, because that's a common criticism, is there's a montage-y part of this, but there are these little details that you notice, like the, like how his skin is looking and his eyes getting progressively
dimmer. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. As kind of time is passing and just little things like, you know, Chani saying, you know, you haven't had one of these nightmares in a while and stuff like that. Right, but I get what you're saying. It's like, there's never a point where we come back and it's like, he's aged up or muscled up and he's like, hey.
Right.
And you're like, oh, shit, homie's been through it.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, a common thing that movies do that this movie shouldn't do. I'm not saying this was the solution, but it's like, that's why you have a training montage music, right? It's like that kind of connects you through like four or five kind of disjointed things to be like, well, this, what we're telling you here is a mini story of this person's rise to leadership and, you know, their skills and stuff like that. And in this, it's just like four very cool and interesting sort of developments that happen, but I have no sense of how much time has passed. But again,
now there's a short scene, but it's like to the Chani Paul music, yeah. The romantic music, and it's very romantic for purposes that I'm excited. Like we'll talk about. I want to talk about when we get to the meaning of this movie. So, Rob, what do you think?
I think I agree with what both of you were saying. Certainly, I have some tiny little nitpicks, but overall, this is such a quality theatrical experience, especially in the premium formats. I don't have IMAX where I live, but I did see it in like a smaller version of that we call AVX, which has amazing sound. I was tweeting about this a couple of days ago because after opening weekend, Warner Brothers was rightfully, proudly sharing the box office numbers and domestically, like almost 50%. Of the ticket sales came from premium formats, which is awesome. And which is so funny because the three of us for so many years have talked about the idea of like the evolving audience and what is worthwhile for that theatrical experience. And it goes back to what I believe it was George Lucas and Spielberg saying, like, this is going to transform over years. This industry and exhibition is going to change where people pay a larger amount and expect these VIP treatments. It has to be a VIP experience. You more space, bigger chairs. You go there for food and drinks and you see on a higher quality screen with higher quality sound. And that's what this is. And it's funny because in our last episode of Podcast X, where you guys tortured me with descriptions of Madam Web, I was telling you, like, I'd seen so much bad product and that's why I wasn't going to see Madam Web. I saw Rebel Moon, I saw Argyle, and I saw The Machine. I'm like, these are such bad movies. Then you get Dune, which is just a great movie. But on top of that, it does so many amazing technical things so incredibly well and raises the bar. And I love the comparison Kofi made to Nolan because these two guys are that. They are doing something special. It almost doesn't matter what genre or time period or whatever fictional material they're adapting from. It's such an impressive feat, these guys. They just do not miss. And sure, I got gripes with Tenet or whatever, and Dunkirk isn't my favorite movie of all time, but man, these are like things, these are must-see next-level modern theatrical experiences. And it was so awesome to be happy, genuinely happy coming out of a movie theater seeing this, even after paying that premium ticket price, and then wanting to go back. I know you asked Ben this. I've only seen it once, but the first movie, I'll say, when I watched the first Dune, I was less in love with that the first time I watched it, mainly because it came out during a pandemic era. I didn't get to see it in theaters the first time. I did see it again, and I made sure to watch the 4K version of it like on the weekend before going to see this. I think I'm going to feel the same about Dune Part 2, where every time I watch it, I appreciate it a little more. And you see a little more detail. You see a little more of the nuance and the character development. And beyond just the incredible casting and the epic scope of it all, it's just so many impressive things to geek out about. And I feel bad because I feel like we're all just taking it for granted because this is what Denis does. You can watch Arrival or Blade Runner 2049. It's like he's just on another level and no one else can compete. And especially, and this is very interesting, come next year or the year after, how does like Star Wars going to compare to this stuff? Because this is like so much better in like every way. You know what I mean? As much as I love Star Wars, that shit looks embarrassing visually and writing wise and cinematically compared to what like everything we see here.
There was never going to be fucking Ewoks in Dune. You know what I mean? Like, I think that goes back to the tone aside,
it's just character and writing and scope, right? And quality.
Well, I know, but
part of it.
Yeah. I think what I'm saying is Star Wars is like kid shit for kids. And that's how they make it still to this day. They're making it on a kid level. And it's just kind of, it's kind of nuts. Like Star Wars being more like Dune would be the Mandalorian never having fucking Grogu in it. Like that's your Dune version of Star Wars.
It's true. I mean, you guys know my thoughts on Star Wars. I mean, I think Andor's on another level and it's like the closest middle ground between your mainstream Star Wars and what this is, where it's like, practical sets, epic scope, like real worlds, real building, you know what I mean? Real stakes and drama. Like, anyways, I'm not here to bash Star Wars, but I do hope this raises the bar that when Lucasfilm sees this, like, oh my God, like you think of battles and landscapes and like these shifting political allegiances, all this kind of stuff that is, core to Star Wars, this does all of it better. And of course we know like there's certainly inspirations from one to the other, from Frank's original books to what Star Wars was, but that's not what we're here to talk about. Look, in the first movie as well, when I watched it every time, I did still feel part of what rubbed me the wrong way with Dune Part 1 is that it just felt too incomplete. It was so obviously setting up for something else. And it's a shame that wasn't built in a way where we knew at the time Dune 2 was going to happen. It was a weird time when that came out with the pandemic of it all. But it just felt so incomplete. I'll never forgive that sequence where we had this, the beginnings of an open field battle where Josh Brolin's character Gurney is charging the Harkonnen forces in the field, and it cuts. I mean, they never return to that scene. We never know what happens. And of course, in this movie, he comes back just like in the original, which is cool to see. But there were so many elements of that. And when it ended, it ended on such a not anticlimactic moment where it just felt like, huh, that's it. Even though this was a long movie, it just felt so unsatisfying at the end of it. As much as I love it and what I did see, this one, however, on its own is so much more complete, and ends with a powerful, big character moments and the tease of an even growing battle, this religious war launching, which is so awesome. But in terms of nitpicks, like there's some little things that were thought, I guess not nitpicks. Like I thought it was kind of funny that the amount of levity they pushed on Stilgar. There's like multiple moments where he and some of his religious friends are like really bringing humor. Sometimes it's warranted. Sometimes it could be slightly out of place, but I still love that character in those moments. So it's fine. There was, I think this speaks to what you were saying when I came back, Ben, about the lack of clarity on the time lapse of it all, I suppose. There was part of that too. I guess, look, Denis uses a convention where he denotes location with text, like on the lower third of the screen, and the date during certain moments. And when we see the Emperor's daughter, I think it says the date and location. In the first movie, they say the date and location, like it's the year 11,000, 10,000, whatever. But then you have the time jumps, and it's a little unclear whether it's a time jump or we're seeing snapshots over the course of 3 months, 6 months, or a year. You know what I mean? That's the part where it gets a little confusing. It is clear to me from all the points Kofi made that time is passing. I don't necessarily know how much, because during those moments, we also flash back to like the Harkonnen planet where we meet what's his face's character, Austin Butler's Fade Routh's character. And Baron Harkonnen's there. So him and his family and fleet had left Arrakis to go here, and then they came back. And so I'm curious like how much time is there during these sequences. I also, during that, the one thing that visually caught me off is like when we are progressing through time and when Paul finally makes the decision to drink the water of life, there's like such a weird, to me, it felt a little awkward how quickly he transitioned to like being, well, A, he's all weird now because of his newfound knowledge and vision, but B, like they change him visually. All of a sudden his cloaks are like just black all of a sudden. And he's like, sure, his skin and eyes are different, but he just feels visually like a, such a different character. And I'm like, I didn't need to be hit over the head as much. It's like, I get it. He's like, I get the archetype there. He just looks not like the hero. And of course, we all know what this story is really about, what it's really saying about the quote unquote hero journey, right? But
no, we do not. But that was the question I want to get to when you're done kind of with your experiences. I want to get
into that. Okay. Well, I'll put one more thing
about.
Yeah. I want to answer that now. I'll answer it when you ask after this. But one last point. It was certainly a choice to cast Christopher Walken as the Emperor and have him just be Christopher Walken. It's like, I love him, man, but it does feel like even the way he communicates as the Emperor, and this is just his way he talks. He just like, it felt like an impression of himself a little bit. Again, it's a minor thing. He's so talented. I love him. And I don't know, when I watch him in Severance, he feels like that's kind of transformative. I feel like he's such a real character in that. In this, I felt like, oh, it's kind of Christopher Walken. And I just keep flashing back to his voice performance and song in The Jungle King. I don't know. I don't know what it is about that, but Jungle King, Jungle Story. What's that book called? Jungle Book. Jesus Christ. I think that we talked about that in the podcast way back when. Anyways, fantastic friggin' movie. It ends in such an exciting way. I do wish they had a little more. They use the voice of Paul Atreides so little. They kind of focus on his physicality as a fighter, like showing how effective he is in the field of battle against the Harvesters, and certainly in his one-on-one duel with Fade Rautha. And that was strange because he didn't feel like he has all that skill. They didn't develop that enough outside of – in the first movie, they had a couple training sequences with him and Gurney there. But I kind of wish we got a little more of that. Now, it doesn't necessarily have to be all huge and buff because Timmy C is certainly a small little dude, but like I kind of wish if his whole thing there is really impressing everybody with how effective a warrior he is, I wish we had a little more of that to back it up. But these are like silly, like tiny nitpicks. So this is such a fantastic goddamn movie and everyone needs to see it. So But yes, so Kofi, do you want to talk about that? What the story
is really about? What's it really about, Kofi?
Yeah. So what's Dune about? Because I have an argument that I believe that Denis Villeneuve has probably cut these two movies up into two volumes that make a lot of sense. And if there's a third one, it'll be kind of one of the best trilogies and split of the trilogies. But again, I think a lot of the meanings of Denis' movies are in the quiet spaces. They're not things that are pronounced. They're not things that are kind of expository or put over your head or something like that. And you really gotta, and I think you gotta watch a lot of his movies multiple times to really be able to pick up on like, what is the internal dialogue between characters? He does a lot with people just looking at each other in rooms. And there's so much of that in this movie. There's so many just glances between Rebecca Ferguson and Timothy and Zendaya, you know, Stilgar and Timothy, and like all these things that people, each character has this deep internal kind of narrative unfolding, and how those things come together in this cast is kind of one of my favorite things about it. Nobody is clean. Nobody is a hero. Everybody's kind of complicated and gray, and is working for their own agendas. And I kind of dig that. That's the kind of why I like the new Game of Thrones era of dramas and things like that, and fantasy drama. But essentially, kind of Dune, and we know this from Frank Herbert into what Denis made is this kind of, to me, especially in the visual subtext of it, like this movie is cast very specifically. Like if you go back and watch Lynch's Dune, there is no subtext there. Everybody's white as shit. Like the Atreides are white as shit. The Harkonnens are just gross white people. And the Fremen are white as shit. They're all white people. In this, there's clearly a different socio-political subtext, because the Fremen are clearly mostly, you know, black, brown, Middle Eastern, Latin people. The Atreides are obviously white. The Harkonnens are obviously super white. Like, you know, so there is a lot of kind of racial, like Nazi white, social, sure. Subtext in this. And so I think a lot of people came away from the first Dune book thinking Paul was a hero. And that's why Herbert wrote Dune Messiah, because he was like, Jesus, you guys fucked this up. Like, you guys have missed the point completely. Like, no. And so he kind of wrote Dune Messiah, where you get to see the kind of more, you know, intense, fanatical version of what Paul and he becomes. I think in Denis' movie, there's a whole subtextual thing about kind of, about legacy, about cultural legacy, and kind of what that does to us and or people who are trapped in their cultural legacies and their cultural bubbles, and how kind of inescapable some of that is. And I think the first part in Dune 1 is all about this kid who, remember, I didn't need a training montage and all that, because I think they do a good enough job of just letting you know, like, this kid's an aristocrat. Like, he's had everything. He's had the trainers, the best, you know, instructors in battle. He reads a lot. He's studious and kind of analytical, and he's really a weird kid in this one, as opposed to, like, you know, captain of the football team, Paul Atreides in the Lynch version with Kyle MacLachlan. And so, like, I got that he was a capable successor to his father, and he cares about these things. And so he's going to be trained up. He's going to be able to, you know, get busy in some combat, because even, you know, that's just some old medieval shit. Like, even if you're a kind of a kid of a nice knightly house, you still learn to be a fucking kick-ass knight. Like, that's just part of it. So I wasn't bothered by that. But I think the first film is all about this kid who comes from this world of privilege and training and all this, getting, you know, thrown out into this other land, this foreign land, and watching everything, all the things that make him, you know, give him these cultural and or racial kind of signifiers of his status are just ripped away. Like, his house is gone. His name don't mean shit. The money's gone. The weapons are gone. And he is kind of thrown out into the wilderness with these other people. And he finds out very quickly just how unprepared he is for the world and kind of how much of a boy he really is and how he can't, you know, he can't save things. He can barely save his mom, who does a lot of saving of him. And at the end of the first film, the climax, quote unquote, is it's a character climax. Like that's that fight with Jamis is the one where he has to become essentially a man, right? Like he's got to man up for the first time and like really not just, it's not the training, it's not the trappings. He's got to actually do shit in the world. And he does it and he kind of proves his way into this other culture. And I think this movie is a very, very powerful kind of like rumination on the fantasy of cultural expansion and growth and saying, oh, you know, I want to just help, you know, indigenous people and do all these things. And the kind of almost like the liberal ideal fantasy of being an ally and doing all that, but how that kind of slams against the very real cultural legacy you're trapped in still. Like, you know, essentially this is about a white boy, a rich white boy who loses all his shit and is like, well, now that I've lost all of my shit, I have perspective. Hey, check out that hot exotic girl. I think I'm going to be cool in this exotic culture and they're awesome and they're noble and all that. But then when it comes down to it, he knows that like the trappings of, you know, rich white boy society that he's got to go back to Saltburn one day and like, you know, claim his legacy. And this movie is kind of like his attempt to deny that fate, but inevitably kind of being sucked back into it because, you know, I think there's a line in the movie near the end where it's a great line that stuck out to me the second time. It's like, I think it's either Paul or Chani says like something like people have made our choices. You know, the world's made our choices for us. Like we've got to do this. Is when they're going south after their home is destroyed. And he's like, yeah, we kind of got it. We don't have choice anymore. Like it's gone. And our like little ideal time is gone. And so I think there's a lot of this movie that hinges around the kind of love story between him and Chani. I mean, that's obviously the last shot of the film, but his idea that he could grow and expand and truly become one with this other culture and do that. And her being skeptical, being like, okay, white boy. And then being like, starting to believe in him and only to see it go into this very sidewards place that is totally against her values and her culture and feeling at the end, like, yeah, like I got screwed. My culture got screwed. And even that is kind of dubious because it's like, yeah, Arrakis is now back in the hands of the Fremen, but the Fremen are also obsessed with going out and killing a lot of other people across the universe and not living their peaceful paradise by the means that, you know, you would have thought. Yeah. And so this cultural invader has come. He's kind of usurped the culture. He's kind of, you know, brought a lot of crazy shit to the planet. And Paul's not a hero for that.
No.
Right? He chooses his, yeah, the legacy, his family, his pride, his personal power, and that's what he chooses. And kind of everybody's kind of shook up about the ending with Florence Pugh and Chani. And I mean, that's what it is. You know, I know 1,000 white guys who dated a black chick in college, but you know what? They settled down and now they're with a girl who's at the suburban X-Fit every Tuesday. You know what I mean? So, so, you know, I think Dune kind of dips into this in a very indirect subtextual way that becomes more and more obvious as you watch it. And it's also about the levers of who controls those kind of levers of power and influence when it comes to religion and government and, you know, riches and whose wealth and all of that. Is there's a whole other kind of condemnation of society in this movie about that and about all those things, because I think what you call like Stilgar's lighter moments, they're not played as lighter in the movie. Like they're just kind of him reacting to things in a genuine way for his character. But it's funny to us because we're like, oh, this guy's like a religious nut. Like that's obvious, right? But it's like, the funny thing is it was uncomfortable laughter in the theater in Tennessee because there's so much of what they say in this movie that is like, you know, Southern Baptist borderline cult church lifestyle is a way of life down here. So yeah, this whole thing and from the Trump of it all, just two leaders who no matter what they do, you're like, oh my God, that's the greatest thing ever. Like that's the favorite line. It's already become a meme and like a breakout line. Like, and he's like, I'm not this Messiah. And he's like, oh, yeah. And it cuts to that scene of him talking to his follow-up friends. He's like, the Messiah is too humble to say he's the Messiah. Therefore, he is the Messiah. And
it's yeah, that's it.
Right, yeah, right.
Yeah, everybody in the theater is just cracking up because we all understand the, on some level,
circular logic there. Yeah.
The circular logic of all religions and the idea of saviors and all of this. And yeah, and so like I think there is a good and just the whole plot that I think because Dune is so thick, it's hard to get people to understand the plot, but like the whole reveal that, you know, there's some big things. Like this guy finds out he's the ultimate white guy. He's like, I'm better than those other white people. Then he's like, oh shit, we're all just inbred cousins, like by the end of this. Like, ah, fuck. Like he's not so separate from these other people. What was I trying to say? Just I lost my train of thought because I was laughing at my own joke in my head, but that the Ben Gesserit, like the whole thing with the Ben Gesserit, that this cultural understanding about religion, like the Ben Gesserit is Christianity, right? Like Christianity went into 1,000 different indigenous peoples who were, I mean, we're watching that in Shogun, from Japan to Africa to Spain to the Latin Americas to, you know, everywhere but the fucking Middle East. But, you know, they spread Christianity and implanted these ideas in 1,000 cultures that never had them before. Just like people forget, like the Fremen prophecy is actually, it's the Ben Gesserit prophecy.
That's it.
They just had emissaries go and implant it within this culture on Arrakis to kind of stoke that possibility. So this whole thing is a political manipulation. It's not real religion or real prophecy, right? So it's all been constructed, and that's the thing that's Chani's whole place in this is like, bro, like you're controlling us and only we should control us. And of course, she's the one person nobody fucking listens to by the end of this movie. So I think when we go back over time and you can watch both together, like I think it'll be an interesting experience to kind of really take in the time, the place that Dune 1 and 2 were made and like what was happening in our culture. And kind of re-examining the movie, because I think that's what Denny was always, based on what he chooses to leave in this story and what he chooses to change, like it's obviously more focused on the socio-political part and not the sci-fi mysticism part, because we don't do any of the weirding way and all that other shit. Like we cut a lot of this. We cut a lot. And that sound, the I mean, like in Dune, there are different there's navigators are just like blobs. They're just like sentient blobs. So there's like also all this other weird alien shit that we just kind of left out of this for a much clearer sociopolitical subtext. So, yeah, man, I mean, I've watched one in 4K on my big TV and then, saw this in IMAX like back to back. And I got to say, and just props for them both being just such different movies. Like the first one is such a different movie when you're just dealing with more of the kind of, for better lack of the term, the Western culture side of it with their technology and all that and kind of getting into it. Like this is a much more naturalistic movie. The sand, the desert obviously is a much bigger player here. The way the scenes are constructed is it's much less CGI filling in natural environments and stuff like that. And IMAX, it is fucking spectacular.
Yeah. So that's what I was referring to when talking about what we all know what the Heroes thing is. So the Frank Herbert's whole thing is like, this is the show, like his belief. We said the idea of a Messiah like figure or a superhero is absolutely devastating for society. And like those inspirations come from whatever his friends that lived in Berlin back when on the rise of Hitler and stuff like that's where it came from, right? What that led to. But I love what you're talking about, Kofi, about how they use these sci-fi tropes, which seem so familiar, whether it's visions or space travel or this grand scale galactic war, to kind of play with these ideas, which seem so they should hit home in such an obvious way. But I love how they play with that. And the Bene Gesserit comparison is also apt because it's so interesting how like even the Emperor's right hand is one of the great mothers, right? It's they're just there playing along the whole fucking time. And it really makes me wonder that for Max, HBO Max, I don't know if they're still doing this or not, but their planned spinoff for the Dune franchise was a Bene Gesserit series. I'm very curious what that would have been about. That would have been about like them setting this up in advance, or like I can't figure out how that would stand alone or how that would tie into these films. I don't know, but
so what is? Yeah, so I guess like I mean that's a good, maybe a good segue into I think in general, it sounds like we all kind of agree about the film as a whole. And I think Kofi's, you know, like analytical reading of it is makes a lot of sense. And I do think that's a lot of what he was going for.
Well, yeah, so like, that's what it's about. I mean, so right now Denis writing Doom Messiah there are 9 books, but the last 2, I think, were written by his son or something like that, or basically 3 yeah. trilogies. So then they skip like centuries and centuries between each one. But in terms of the OG 3, yeah, I'm very curious how the film will adapt the end of the Paul aspect of it all.
Because he wrote Frank Herbert wrote like 6 of them, right?
6 or 7, yeah. And his son wrote the last ones, yeah.
Right. So is the plan here that like, I mean, there's no way that Denis is going to do all of these, right? So
no, he's going to do Messiah.
Okay.
He's got like, what'd he say? He quoted this week saying he's doing like 4 other films.
Pay you each $100 if we ever see God Emperor of Dune made into anything like a movie. Because this shit gets so fucking weird. Like, I don't need to see the people totally. Turning into worms aspect of this.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's my brother like has read them all. He's describing it to me, and it's like just ludicrous. And even you get hints of that if you go back and watch the miniseries. They did a 6-part miniseries with William Hurt was in the first part, and then they followed up with another 6-part miniseries based afterwards. And it's like the next son in the lineage, and it's a young James McAvoy playing him. Got his kind of career launch there, and he's like, if you look at his, he's like physically transforming into like a worm. His arms, it's so weird, dude. And that's just the beginnings of the weirdness. But yeah, Kobe's right. They are holding back some of the more extreme things that they did not show you. The internals of how some of those ships operate, or how that wormhole thing works, and how the spice is essential for interstellar travel. And they also don't get too heavy into like the visions, even though it's an essential part.
No, prescience is a big thing. That's why they cut Tim Blake Nelson, because Fenring, his whole thing is like he's prescient immune, which becomes a huge kind of plot point in the later books. Because
what's that even mean?
Prescience is when Hawk and prescience is the ability to see the past, present and future, to basically see across clairvoyant throughout all time.
Okay.
And that's like when Paul is saying, like, I see possible futures, the past.
Yeah, so that part made sense.
Entire bloodline. Like, so there's more. It's not just the, because there's always these different names for the Messiah, the Kachi Hashwat, or whatever the fuck his name is. Like, that he's a very, the whole thing is they were breeding to find a male who could have that level of vision. And along the way, there are a lot of failed candidates. So there were people who showed like they might get there, but then Avengers was like, nah, you ain't it. Fuck you. And Fenring, the Emperor's best friend, is one of them. He's like the greatest assassin in the Empire and the Emperor's best friend. And he's Leia Sidhu's husband. He's not in this movie, but yeah, he was supposed to be what Paul Atreides becomes, but then he was turned out to be like a failed candidate. But he's prescient immune, so like one of the best thing for him being an assassin is none of those mystics can see what he's doing ever. They never know where he is or what he's doing or what he's going to do, because nobody can see him in visions. And so in later generations after Paul, like prescience becomes so big that the entire fucking chess game of Dune politics is people trying to outwit each other using prescience. And to figure out like who's going to do what and what futures are there, and then to find the best futures. And so it just becomes like a mystical fucking chess game like that. And so, yeah, there's a lot about that in the Bene Gesserit powers in general, the transmutation, the voice, the prescience visions and all of that, and the psychic abilities to talk to each other. Like all of that shit is on the table in the books in a big way.
When he transforms in this film, in the third act, and he becomes like, he's had the water of life, and he's like very willingly taking his place as the leader and shouting at everyone and rallying the troops or whatever. I thought that when that led to this one-on-one with Fade Rautha, that he was going to have extra abilities, because he did explicitly say what you said. He can see the future, he can see it clearly now, and he can see all different versions of it. I thought he was going to have that sort of ability in the fight. Almost as if he can predict the moves of his opponent. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I thought that was going to be the display of like, oh my God, this guy is on another level. Because if you go back, they adapted this in different ways in the previous versions, right? In the original movie, they have like the sound power and he pushes like Sting to the floor, if I remember correctly, or some shit like that. And then in the miniseries, they give him enhanced speed. So
yeah, it's a weirding way. The ability to like phase and do all this stuff was called the weirding way. And it's
so
like,
I wasn't sure if they were going to make him it would have justified his ability as like, oh my God, this guy's not this guy, he's the Messiah. He's like next a godlike warrior. Yeah. Yeah. You know what I mean? But instead he felt it was very standard 101 and he took a knife wound, two knife wounds. So yeah, that was the only, yeah, I wasn't sure. So they're really holding back on that part. So I do wonder if they're going to push that at all. And
I think they don't, and this is me kind of reaching, but I think because it mirrors what happens at the end of the first film. And at the end of the first film, they do show you that he sees the duel with Janice or Jamis, and he sees himself lose that one. And then
that's it.
And so like, I feel like he did kind of do that. They didn't show you, but I think at that point, that's why he takes the two knives in his body and like, he's just sitting there taking the pain. And then he just like, he stabs him because I think he knows that's the way he's got
it.
Right. Like, he's not going to, but he has to kind of risk it.
The other thing I don't know, but I'm curious. Maybe you know. I've not read the books myself, but the way they set up Lea Seydoux as having the offspring of Fade Rautha now, and of course Lady Jessica is going to give birth to Paul's sister. Like, I'm curious how much of that generation is going to be involved in the third movie, or if that's just
set up. Brother, we are not done with the Harkonnen line yet. No, it's not just what you know the baby she's carrying. Bro, like, you find out in Dune that, like, this ability to look down your bloodline and revisit the past, it's not just passive. Like, those motherfuckers can talk back to you, and they can get real ghosty on you, and it becomes a thing. So, yeah, the Harkonnens are not done in this series yet, and it gets fucking weird with Parle's sister. If you ever want to read the wiki about her story, like, that shit gets weird. I mean, we don't know if we're ever going to see this or if they're going to do it, so I'll just tell you, but, like, yeah, she gets possessed. Her power is so great, like because she had the water of life in the womb, that like she's so connected to her bloodline. She gets possessed by Baron Harkonnen, and like that's he comes back as her and like fucking
jeez.
Possesses her. Yeah, because you know they're related, and she has to do the fucking Tommen out the window or off a big height and to fucking stop him from coming back. And that whole shit gets crazy weird.
Whoa!
Yeah,
I remember her
also. Yeah. Oh no. Sorry. Go ahead.
I was just saying that in the Lynch movie, they kind of randomly throw her in the second half of the film, and she's like incredibly powerful and weird. That's all we know about her.
She kills the Baron, and I think she's the one that kills the Baron in that one.
That's it.
Yeah. So, like, yeah. Also, yeah. I mean, the real Dune book is so fucking weird because Jamis has a wife. When like they cut this part, and you can see why people couldn't handle the Florence Pugh, but Jamis has a wife. When you kill in the Fremen culture, like if you kill her husband, she has to either become your servant or your wife for a year. And Paul's like, oh. And so he makes her his servant for like a year because he's like in love with Chani. But she ended up being like the daughter's the daughter's nursemaid and like fucking raising the new generation of Atreides. She marries Stilgar and like does all this crazy shit. Yeah, it's nuts, bro. Like, yeah, but it's such a weird thing because it's like this weird sexual tension because she's like, yes, I'm yours for a year. And Paul's is like, what?
Yeah. This is such a, it's so funny too because it's like, I mean, the way the books are written, you can tell it's almost like soap operatic or whatever. It's kind of like that's like characters are just kind of like functions and stuff in some of these. Like, it's like, oh, no one really cares about this. So we're going to like make this person do this thing. And it's just like the ideas were more interesting than the characters sometimes. But when you translate that to film, it is like, that's why you get this weird shit where you're trying to like picture a scenario where like Anna Taylor-Joy is being possessed by like, you know, like her fucking whatever, like grandfather and shit. Like, I don't know.
Hey, yeah, shout out to this movie for putting a talking baby womb in it and having that shit work.
Yeah.
No, and Rebecca Ferguson for playing Jessica, like crazy, man. She's so good.
She commits in that shit. Yeah.
It's interesting, like the reveal of the Harkonnen thing, because you know Paul is essentially what he's Atreides and Harkonnen and Bene Gesserit, right? He has all these. Yeah. Things and he's the only male to take the water of life, so he's got like everything going for him. Kofi, I'm not familiar with the other houses outside of like the video games, the old Westwood Command and Conquer style video games of the 90s. Do we get to see much of the other great houses, the ones that are like kind of lining up over Arrakis at the end of the film?
I think more so. And can you hear me? Am I okay?
Yeah,
you're fine.
Get to get an expanded picture of like what the universe is. I mean, the book does describe this, and don't ask me to remember because I've had to read every Dune wiki just to get the basics down of this shit again. But yeah, dude, it's Dune. There's a reason why people don't jump into Dune regularly. It is so actually fucking dense to just get the universe built and understand what you're reading, the character story. Like I said, the navigators and all that. So I don't remember exactly like what the distribution is. I know like some of the bigger houses are like Fenring was like, that's a whole big thing in like the books. But I think at Dune Messiah, you do get like a more expanded look at the universe and kind of more of that layout because it's not, obviously it's not as pertinent to the first book.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, man.
Man, yeah. Well, I'm curious. I am very curious, like, where all this is going to go and, like, how far they're going to take this franchise. Because, like, I can definitely see, you know, a third movie with Denis at the beginning or at the head of it, rather, like, kind of finishing whatever the story is that he's telling. But well, it's like, who do you get for the fourth story or something, you know? Like,
well, that's the thing. Like, and Kofi placed the funny bet on that. Like, Denis will finish the trilogy, but that's sort of the it for this main, I mean, I say main, but the Paul arc, I suppose, right? But the other one skipped, like, whatever it is, Kofi will know, like 1,000 years or something. So I think, you know, if the IP is as valuable as it seems to be, and this gets close to, I mean, I don't know if we can guess all day how much money this will make, but if it gets anywhere near, I don't know, what is it? It's going to do better than Wonka, I hope, right? So 600, 800. Million or something, if it has legs, I don't know. It would be insane if it made $1 billion after an $85 million opening, but we'll see. That would be magical. But point is, like, if the third one is well received and makes bank, Warner Brothers and IP, man, they're going to want to continue somehow. I could see another director coming in, them trying to do another Dune epic, but like Kofi said, it's so goddamn weird, and you have a whole new cast, so I don't know how you make that work. And but that's a question for like 6 years from now, I guess. But
yeah. Well, I mean, I would definitely watch another one. So, and I am like, I mean, I knew this was sort of setting up the larger confrontation. So I kind of knew where we were headed, but it was nonetheless like, I mean, it is a satisfying end of this, like this chapter of the story, but it does feel incomplete again, because you want to see that, like that, you want to see what happens next. So, I mean, I hope they do get it together to do that, but. All right, you guys want to quickly hit on a few shows you guys are watching?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, I haven't watched either Shogun or The Last Airbender. I told you guys I'm watching Daredevil season 3 at everyone's request. So I'm gonna tell you my funny story about Daredevil season 3 really quick.
All right.
And then we'll cut over to like what you guys wanna talk about. So you guys told me that, you know, like the evolution of Bullseye in this story is like, you know, kind of like the best part of, you know, the arc and stuff. And just like watching him kind of like, you know, like emerge, and you don't kind of initially necessarily like realize it's Bullseye, or, you know, at the very least, it's kind of like a grounded storytelling of this person sort of going nuts and becoming this like supervillain. So I was watching this thing with kind of the, for whatever reason, just sort of like watching for that, and completely for the first, like, I think 3 episodes until Fisk's, like, you know, like the cars, the FBI cars or whatever attacked, had thought that you guys were saying that Ray Nadine, the special like agent that's in charge of Fisk, was going to be the one that becomes Bullseye. And I was like, if they do this, this is going to be the fucking heel turn of the century. Like, I was like trying to figure out how, because he starts off as kind of like a bit like conflicted. Like, they set him up with all this, like, oh, he's, you know, he's got financial problems. He's a good guy. He's got financial problems. He's kind of like talking to Fisk. Like, I had no idea that it was like the Poindexter character until that scene where they like attack the cars. And I was like, oh, this makes a lot more sense. But I was kind of disappointed when it ended up being Poindexter, because I was really curious to see how this character was going to become like, you know, like was going to shift into the Bullseye persona and what that was going to mean for his family and shit. But
it's Poindexter, because he's so kind of out of nowhere. He's just a guard of the car, it seems. And then it's all just dialogue driven when he's talking to, you know, figuring out his shit. And he tells his like origin story, and it's like, holy crap. Like, he's super psycho. And it's
good. Yeah. I mean, it's cool. Like, it is great. I mean, I've definitely been enjoying season 3. I'm glad they kind of ditched the like, oh, the character loses his powers story at the beginning, because that I was worried that was going to carry further into the season than it did, which I always think is kind of like, I mean, that happens in every chapter two or three of any, like every superhero franchise, it feels like, or used to.
Yeah.
So I was glad that kind of got ditched and we sort of got back on track. But yeah, I mean, it is a great season. I'm glad you guys are pushing me to watch it.
Yeah, the stuff at the beginning is more just finalize, but round out the story of his family, I guess, right? Because it's about his mom and stuff, right? So
Yeah.
It's funny. I almost forgot about the agent until you brought that up now. I got to rewatch this show. Like, that's not the memorable part for me.
You should watch it thinking that he's going to become Bullseye because it's a real fucking ride.
Well, yeah. I knew it wasn't because, like Kofi said a phrase times in the podcast, that dude who plays – I forget his name now, Poindexter. Like, he was in the running to play
Wilson Bethel.
That's it.
Right. Wilson Bethel.
He was in the running to play Captain America. So I remember seeing lots of images of him. So once I saw him, you know, without his gear, I realized who it was. Right. So,
yeah. That's cool anyway. Though. I mean, yeah, I wish I had watched it at the time and I kind of have that experience. Cause I'm sure that was like a lot more fun kind of like discovering that some. And
dude, that episode, before. The Man. Origin episode blew everybody's fucking mind. That shit was insane.
Yeah. Yeah. It's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he does a great job as that character. I will give him that. Like the sort of way that character disassociates into the Bullseye role is interesting, and also just kind of like the desperation and fear that he has over his own like inability to sort of control his own, you know, whatever, stick to the routine. Like he needs this routine, and that keeps him from doing bad things and whatever. Like his fear and desperation is like, that's not something we see in like a supervillain a lot. So that I agree with you guys there's something special about the way that was sort of portrayed here.
Also, this is the larger arc of having Fisk back. I remember what this came after that weird season two, where it's like Punisher and Elektra and stuff like that. And I remember when we were all screaming back then, like after season two, we spoke to Charlie Cox and he says, man, we asked him what he wanted. He's like, I really want to get back to basics with Fisk. And then I'd love to see Daredevil Bullseye, I mean, get introduced, and you've got exactly all of that. So, and now they're all back again for Daredevil Born Again, which is currently shooting. So very exciting. Yeah.
It's cool. I mean, I do feel like that second season in hindsight, now watching this, like I see why you guys were as like high on this as you were, because it's like, it's not trying to introduce a whole bunch of new characters and like blow this thing wide open and be like a shared universe or something. It's kind of just like, we're going to introduce a really great villain. We're going to bring back a villain you like, and we're going to do something like that feels genuine with the main sort of three heroes of the series. Because like Foggy is significantly less annoying in this one than he is in season two as well. His arcs is still kind of weird, but like I feel like that was one of I remember Andrew Dice just railing on like what a like ninny Foggy was about everything in the second season. So I remember that specifically. I think maybe that was the Total Geek All Days or something, but
yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean that's all the time we have to dedicate to that, but I'll let you guys know when I'm done with it. I got a little bit distracted with like Curb coming back and some other things that I've been enjoying watching, but yeah, I'm almost ready for Born Again whenever that thing comes out. Shogun then. Kofi's been watching Shogun. Rob's been watching The Last Airbender.
Well done. Holy shit.
Let's start with Shogun. Yeah, let's go to Shogun.
Yeah. I don't know, man. I feel frustrated because I thought it was going to be a wave, but a lot of y'all in America out here capping as per usual. You know, you get a Japanese language thing with some subtitles and everybody's like, oh, I hear it's good. I've been meaning to get that. They got an English dub for you fucking assholes. So just go on Hulu and watch the English dub. But yeah, I mean, I feel like people are watching the show, but the buzz should be much bigger than what it is. But again, America going to America. So I'm not going to try to, you know, recruit anybody. But this is based on the James Clavell novel of 1975. And if you have never read it, it is a book that I was in college when I read it, and like instead of going out drinking and partying, I was spending like a summer reading this book so intently, because this was Game of Thrones long before Game of Thrones was a thing, and it's based on very real history, and you can go on comicbook.com. I did a write-up of the real history. Like some of this history is point for point what you see in this show, including the dates that it's all occurring. This is a fictionalized version of real Japanese history, and it's fucking fascinating. So Shogun is like, I mean, I just tweeted out that like after three eps now, like there is this show and the rest of fucking TV that's on, in my opinion. And I'm just like, yeah, it's crazy how much you, between this and Dune, it's like you give really skilled visionaries and creators a chance to make something. You use some practical sets and invest in actual practical filmmaking, and you come away with some dope shit. Like, the production values on this show are insane. The costuming, just the recreation of feudal era Japan and the sets that you get, like, from the details of the weapons and just all the things. People are gritty, like, teeth are muddy. Like, it's just so well done of building out this feudal Japanese world. And in just three episodes, episode one is just all kind of literally throwing you into the world. It's about the first English sailor who ever reaches Japan, and in this show called John Blackthorne. And it's about what happens when he gets there and how his arrival completely fucking changes the socio-political structure of Japan at one of the most pivotal periods in the nation's history, when the Takeo, this guy who had nearly conquered Korea and really started to be the first of what we call the three great unifiers of Japan, to bring everything together and the clans and different classes and all that. He dies, and he kind of smartly leaves his five top lieutenants or regents in charge to share power until his son comes of age. His son is like 6 or 7, and he's got to wait till he's 16. So it's like 10 years or 8, 10 years. And there's one lord he trusts the most, named Toranaga, who's our boy from Mortal Kombat, for Hiroyuki Sanada. And this dude is like, there's an early scene with him and a hawk, and he's taking his hawk out to catch, you know, hunt another bird. And he talks about how clever she is using the sun to kind of block herself out by flying against the sun so that her prey can't see her. Anyway, he's very fucking crafty, and he realizes kind of what this English sailor may be about. Because if you don't get what Japan was isolated. It was its own world, but the Portuguese trading company in had kind of found Magellan's Pass and found the route to Asia long before. So Spain, Portugal, like other nations and people related with them, they found it, but they started to conquer it through religion. They used Catholic religion and sent Catholic emissaries as their primary kind of thing. So just bringing us back to this Fremen conversation, the Ben Gesserit. So they seeded all these other nations with Catholicism to be able to make them follow leaders, and then they would implant their own leaders through the religion. And so the Englishman who arrives on the shores is a Protestant. And so they're at war. England and Portugal and all this were in this kind of world expansion conquer war. And it's what happens when the Japanese begin to realize what the fuck is going on in the outside world, that their kind of kingdom is being divvied up by these kings and people who have never been there and consider them like less, and what the real, and this Englishman realizing that Japan is a far more sophisticated and nuts place in the world than Westerners realize. And so, yeah, man, there's a lot of political maneuvering. There's assassins, there's ninjas, there's fucking wars and crazy ass battles. In episode 3 was simply a palace escape episode that could have been like the penultimate episode of a Game of Thrones, right? Like at the end of the season, it's the entire episode is an escape from a palace and a war to get in a battle to get out of fucking town. And it is every time this show is on, like the rest of the world doesn't fucking matter to me. Like it's just like a straight hour of greatness. And yeah, Shogun is already the best TV show of 2024 in my book. And I'm fairly sure, unless some people come with some real fucking heat, that by the end of the year, I'll still be putting it on top of my lists. And like I said, if you're complaining there's no premium quality TV out there, then you're just not watching something with like more Japanese language, which makes total sense for this show, because a big part of the book in the story is how translators can become political weapons. That when you have to have somebody changing, you know, translating your words are they doing it correctly? Are the people who are wanting the translation, you know, confident that they're getting the truth? And like all the maneuvering around that too is a big part of the story. So the language actually makes sense in this when people are speaking Japanese and people are speaking Portuguese, which is represented as English. Like it all is part of the story. So I recommended watching it in natural form, but like, yeah. By the end of episode two, you're locked in. You're like, oh shit, shit's going to go down. And by episode three, you're like, oh fuck, shit is really already going down. And you're like, oh man. But yeah, Shogun is a fantastic novel and is a fantastic show.
It's awesome. All right, Rob, probably go ahead.
I also jumping real quickly on this. I haven't seen it, but you guys know FX is my all-time favorite network for everything they do. We don't have Hulu in Canada, but you know, FX is the go-to place. And it's funny you say that, Kofi, but the audience actually, surprisingly enough, Shogun is one of our top things site-wide now, and has been since launch. And so much so that we set up episodic, like postmortem style interviews. So I'm glad it's doing super well. I've not watched it myself yet, but I just finished what I'll talk about next, Avatar: The Last Airbender, yesterday. So this is next on my list. So, and in terms of Sanada, what's funny about him is that, you know, not to turn everything into a Marvel conversation, he was of course in Avengers Endgame when my boy Hawkeye took him out in the intro there, but he was a key character in The Wolverine. And when I did the set visit for that, this is, holy crap, this is like 12 years ago now. I'll never forget, like, all the props guys and the stunt coordinators and the ADs. Remember that movie, David Leitch, our man from John Wick and Nobody fame and Fast and Furious and Deadpool 2, all these things. Everyone universally said, when it comes to the sword training and fighting, they've never met an actor on the planet who can handle a sword like Sanada, like in real life. Like, that guy just is such an absolute master outside of what you see on screen, right? So I'm glad to see him get a role like this and continue that on. So he's and of course he had like the best scene in Mortal Kombat, like you said. So he's the man. Okay, I'll talk very quickly about The Last Airbender. So for me, the Airbender like anime, which came out Nickelodeon, I don't remember now, 15 years ago or something, is in my top three greatest animated programming of all time. And when I watched it, and I forget how many episodes it was, but it was like 30-minute episodes, 24 season, whatever how it used to be. And it was divided into three books, seasons. And it took me a while to get into it. Everyone at the time was praising it, and it got bigger and bigger. And of course, many years later, it came to Netflix and really fucking exploded, which was the impetus for them really pushing ahead on this live action adaptation. But I'll never forget the first, like, I don't know, it would have been like half a dozen episodes or something. It really took me a while to get into the tone and understand the characters. Because it has, like, you know, it's definitely leaning towards the a younger audience. And there's some cheesy character moments, but once you understand the characters and see how much heart there is, and how this main character Aang, how he just, is reacclimatizing himself to the world and finds so much love and heart and these little side character stories and adventures and nature and all these things, it became something special. And that only got better and better and better. And as these characters developed and went on, and it became truly one of the greatest, not just animated shows, but like one of the greatest shows I've ever seen in my life. It's a very special show. So adapting that into live action is a challenge. And for a while there, the original creators were on board. They separated from Netflix for whatever creative differences. And Albert Kim took over as the showrunner. And it's only 8 episodes, longer form. It's closer to an hour. Very tough thing to do. They shot it in Vancouver. And similar type of thing. I watched the first, I want to say, 2 or 3 episodes. And it just felt like they were simultaneously rushing through what was a longer book in the original version. But also missing some of the core things, which like – that made Aang so special. They missed some of those fun side adventures. They're missing some of his training. The whole thing, Ben, I don't know if you're – I think Kofi and I have spoken about Avatar before, but have you guys seen the original Avatar show?
I've tried to watch it 3 times and I failed. I can't stand it. I can't get into it.
Actually,
I tried.
Such an anime fan you are now. I'm shocked.
No, I mean, it's not anime. It's American anime. It's fucking nuts. But
it's ahead of its time.
No, I've tried.
Though, but yeah.
Yeah, I tried 3 times and I couldn't. And again, this show – I've watched the pilot 4 times, and each time I've been like, this is one of the worst pilots I've ever seen in my life.
It's bad. I'm telling you, it's
in live action. Like, I've watched episode 2 and tried to watch 3 because I know they're going to do the rest. And I hear the rest of the books are the ones that'll really get me into it. So I'm trying to see. But man, yes. I can never finish this shit. I can't finish it now. I can't finish it then.
Sorry, I think you and I will have this conversation at some point in the future, and I hope by then you will have whatever forced yourself to get through a few more and find a hook to bring you through, because you know obviously seasons 2 and 3 are going to be big. But Ben, in your case, have you seen it?
So I haven't seen this. I've seen the old anime, the first couple seasons, and then I never followed through on it. But I haven't seen this yet. I was actually talking to Ashley last night about wanting to start this.
Yeah.
But I heard kind of mixed things, so I didn't.
Well, no one says mixed things about the original show. That's for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
It's universally acclaimed. For me, my personal journey was like, it was a tough watch the first few episodes, and then it became an absolute addiction and immensely rewatchable too. This show overall, not as good as the original, but it does have some important things that are worth noting. So anyways, the first three episodes, I felt the same way as Kofi said. It was tough. It wasn't very quality. Nothing was really working. But then there's like a moment, I think it's episode four, and it happens in the episodes four, five, and six, I think, where it genuinely had me tearing up at each time. And it comes down to the same thing that was the highlight of the original show, which is the relationship between Uncle Iroh and Prince Zuko, who's like this outcast prince trying to re-earn his place under his father's guise, right? As the future Fire Lord of the Fire Nation or whatever. And their journey and how complicated it is and how they unravel their layers of how they got to where they are and the sacrifices they made are just so powerful and their relationship is so great. And by the way, the guy playing Uncle Iroh is Paul Sun-Hyung Lee from Kim's Convenience, but he's our favorite Carson Teva X-Wing pilot from The Mandalorian. Such a likable, awesome Canadian dude. And he plays like such – I feel like he has like up there the most screen time and very rightfully so. He's such a wondrous, amazing character and had me tearing up multiple times. And once you get those moments and at the same time, they finally do something with some of the other leads, not necessarily Aang who does bring that young sort of charm and naivete to the world. And as he kind of learns his role and his bigger journey, he has to go on as the Avatar and someone who has to kind of save and unite the world. But it's it's Katara and Sokka, the two the brother and sister who are from the Water Tribe that join him on this journey. Their relationship really kicks up a notch, and it becomes powerful. And all those kind of moments start to pay off in the back half of the season. So overall, the show is a bit messy, and there's missing parts of it. And like there's this is going to sound weird, but one of the big parts of Avatar is that Aang has this flying air bison called Appa. It's like a six-legged flying beaver tail. It's this fucking absurd thing. But it's a lovable, big, friendly creature from the show. Everyone loves him. This thing just like vanishes and comes back, you know, in present day. They skip 100 years. And then like for one episode, it's not there. And the next episode, it's there. And it picks him up. And I'm like, where the fuck are they keeping this gigantic, friendly beast? Like, how is it just not here in half the scenes? It's just so goofy how they just kind of forget that. And by the way, Aang's whole journey is that he has to go around. He's the last airbender, as the title would denote. He has to go around and learn how to waterbend, earthbend, and firebend to become the Avatar. He has to master all four elements. And this whole first season or first book out of three, he has not done 1 second of training in any of the other elements, even though he's with a waterbender the entire show. So I'm like, are they like forgetting the plot? So it's just like there's little things like that, which are really weird, and some awkward and goofy character moments. And they're having a tough time balancing like the target demo. I think there's moments I feel like this is for 6 year olds, and then you have like death and destruction and lost family members. It's like, wait a second, this is definitely more YA, edging towards it. So they're tonally a little bit lost, but I have a feeling the long development of this made this production a bit of a mess, and they had a tough time balancing what to include and what to not include in live action format. And it's a shame because there's so much more to this, and it really is about character journeys, and they cut out a lot of that. But by the end of it, as grand and over the top it seems, it actually is worth continuing. So I'm glad the news came out this week that they are doing seasons 2 and 3. A funny story about that: 15 minutes before Netflix dropped that on Twitter, I got a text from someone saying, Season 2 and 3 confirmed. I'm like, is this real? I'm like, is it going to be announced soon? And like, maybe the next 2 weeks. And then 15 minutes later, they fucking announced it. Like, oh, God damn it. I was just starting to research this. It deserves to continue, even though I feel like there's some improvements that need to be made. So one day you guys should watch it. But I do recommend watching the original series first if you can ever get yourself through it. I know there's a lot of episodes there, but it's totally worthwhile.
Awesome. Well, that was everything that we wanted to touch base on this week. Should we just wrap it up?
Yeah, I think so.
Sure. Okay.
All right. Well, I have been your host, Ben Kendrick. You can follow me at Ben Kendrick on all the socials. You can check out what I'm doing over at Static Media. We run Looper and Slash Film. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Mr. Rob Keyes.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Rob_Keyes. That's K-E-Y-E-S. On Scream It this week, I was finally able to talk about and share more of my journey last year to Africa, to Tanzania. And then I wrote up a big thing with hundreds of photos. So you can read about some of the things we got to do and see in person on Screen Rant. I'll just say, man, if there's a theater near you in premium format, go see Dune. And then if you got FX or Hulu, you got to see Shogun. These are like the type of programs you only get once in a while that get the 10 out of 10 reviews sort of across the board. So go support the good art.
All right, Mr. Piala, special guest.
The only non-white savior up here, keeping it real for all my Fremen. I hold you down and all my potential shogunates. Love you. Long live the fighters, baby.
All right. Well, that'll do it for this week's episode. We will be back probably next week. I don't know what we'll be doing next week, but we'll think of something. Have a good week, y'all.